Nice to be here with you again. I find it delightful, this opportunity to be connected this way, even though, you know, I've said this a number of times. I think 3 months ago I would have thought someone was crazy if they said that this format would be delightful and there'd be 25 people right in front of me in a little thumb tile with another 25 people behind them or to the side of them or wherever those other people on the other page are. Where are you? I have to push the little blue arrow and then I see you. I do it periodically and try to go back and forth a little bit. And it's fun. It's nice. Thank you. Thank you for being part of it. And I loved what Andrea said this morning about the meditative mind is simple. And I don't know if she set me up to give a simple talk or if she set me up to make it all too complicated since I'm going to supposed to be talking about not-self. And so is that simple? Is that complicated? I think it's supposed to be simple. Sometimes this whole not-self teaching is a complicated teaching to let you know you can have a simple meditative mind. So the topic is clear comprehension of non-delusion. And you might ask, why not clear comprehension of wisdom? My interpretation and my delight around this idea of clear comprehension of non-delusion is that, as Andrea said, we understand what delusion is, and we learn to see through it or to shed it, abandon it, not be fooled by it. But then we don't make up something else as being the thing. If you think wisdom is the point, then you might think there's some particular kernel of a great idea, some profound statement, something that represents that wisdom that you could carry with you or refer to like it's a thing, like it's a real understanding, like a little aphorism or something. But non-delusion doesn't leave you with anything. Doesn't leave you with wisdom. It just leaves you with freedom from delusion. And I think that's great. It's great not to be left with anything. If what we want is a simple mind, not a simplistic mind. I spent a little bit of time with Munindra Ji, the Vipassana teacher in India. And I made a little bit of a mistake in India one day. And I went back to tell him what I'd done, and he said, "Gil, mindfulness is to be simple, but don't be a simpleton." So that's how I got chastised. And so here we are, to have clear comprehension of the non-delusion around the whole idea of self. So I wanted to begin a little bit where Andrea left off, or, you know, follow up on what she did yesterday. Like her, I really love the Bahiya Sutta. And there's a number of other texts in the suttas, in the teachings, where the Buddha gives the same teaching. But the context is a little bit different. So it might be nice to share with you this other story and then to hear the same teaching. But then I want to emphasize a piece of it as a segue into this idea of not-self. So it has to do with a monk. This time it's one of the Buddha's disciples, who is apparently ardent and resolute, and quite old. And he goes to visit the Buddha, and he pays his respects, and he tells the Buddha, very much like Bahiya did, could you tell me the Dharma in brief? So, you know, if you don't have much time and you get to hang out with the Buddha, that's a good, you know, can we get it in brief? Can I get it in a nutshell? And with Bahiya, the Buddha said, you know, not now. I'm about to go on my alms. And Bahiya asked three times, and then he got it. But with the monk, the Buddha didn't require him to ask three times. But according to Bhikkhu Bodhi, he did kind of little bit admonish him. And I think Bhikkhu Bodhi's commentary is, or maybe from the commentaries, is that this monk, Mulunkyaputta, maybe had waited too long to really start practicing. You know, he was an old person already. So the Buddha said to him, hear now, Mulunkyaputta, what should I be saying to young monks when you, aged, old, elderly, along in years, come at the last stage of life to ask for the teachings in brief? So I don't quite understand, but he clearly, you know, emphasizes, you're ancient. And, you know, what can I say? And the Mulunkyaputta replies, even though I am aged, old, elderly, along in years, come to the last stage of life, may the Blessed One teach me the Dhamma in brief. May the well-gone one teach me the Dhamma in brief. It may well be that I'll understand the Blessed One's words. It may well be that I'll become an heir to the Blessed One's words. To become an heir to his words means to, you know, become enlightened. And then the next piece of it is very nice. The Buddha does something that in other traditions they call a pointing out instruction. In other words, he's going to point to a state of mind that is going to give Mulunkyaputta a kind of maybe a visceral, immediate sense, feeling, experience, reference point to hear the Bahiya instructions. So the Buddha says, what do you think? When there are things that you can see with your eyes, however, you have never seen them. Not only have you never seen them before, you don't even know what they are. So there are things in the world out there to be seen, but you've never seen them, and you don't have no idea what those are. No one's told you even what the objects are. So unseen and unknown things out there. In that case, do you have any desire, lust, or love for those objects? And Mulunkyaputta says no. So it kind of makes a little bit of sense that, you know, someone says, you know, there's something out there. There's a lot of things out there in the world. There's something really out there in the world that you don't even know what it is, and you've never seen it. And I guess it's possible to fall in love or have lust for anything, but the idea of this blank, this not knowing. There's no associations of pleasure or beauty or something that you want to possess. And this idea that, no, in that case, there is this feeling, this experience of no desire, no lusting, no loving or delighting in it. And then the Buddha goes through, kind of like a guided meditation, for each of the senses. Somewhere out there in the world, there's a sound that you've never heard about, and you've never you know, you don't know what it is, would you then have any desire or lust or craving or love for that? And so Mulunkiputta says no. And what about anything that you smell? There's a smell out there, but you've never smelled it, never heard of it, don't have no idea what it is. Would you have craving for that? No. And I can imagine that as Mulunkiputta is hearing this, he's kind of, after all, the Buddha is talking about this and giving him the instructions in brief. So this is probably like, you know, this is the end of his life, and he's really paying attention. And these questions really hit him. You know, he's really feeling his way into the answer. He's trying to understand, what is he saying, and where's the answer? How can I be truthful to this man, the Buddha? And he says, no, there would be no desire, no lust, no craving. And maybe each time the Buddha goes through this, there's a fuller kind of sense, intuition, experience, recognition of a mind that has none of these kinds of craving. And what about if it was tastes? A taste you never tasted, you've never heard about before, you don't have no idea what it is, would there be desire or craving? What about sensations of the body, some kind of bodily sensation that you've never felt, don't even know what it is, and never, no idea, would you crave it? No. And what about ideas that your mind can know, things cognizable by the mind, but you've never cognized it before, you've never had these ideas or thoughts, and you have no idea what in the world they are, would you have craving for something like that? No. Then the Buddha continues, Mulunkiputta. Now remember, for the Buddha to go through these six senses, he's going through all the ways that we can have a direct experience of life. Everything we experience that is through those filters of those six things, mostly people live in cognitive world of ideas and stories and associations and projections. But those also begin in the six senses. Everything has a start there. So to point back to the beginning of it all, the essence of direct experience, is a very powerful thing if you're able to right be there. And in each of those sense doors, Mulunkiputta has the experience of what it's like to not have any craving in relationship to them, in reference to them. So then the Buddha continues, then Mulunkiputta. This is a different translation that Andrea used yesterday. In reference to the scene, let there only be the seen. In the reference to the heard, let there only be the heard. In reference to the sensed, let there only be the sensed. In reference to the cognized, let there only be the cognized. That is how you should train yourself. So the experience that Mulunkiputta has just had is a pointing to his being present, alive, aware, with what it's like not to have any craving in relationship to something that's seen or heard or cognized or sensed in the other senses. And then when the Buddha says, in the heard, in the seeing, just a seeing, he has a clear reference point for what that means. One way it means is that to let it just be there, the seen and have no desire in relationship to it, no craving in relationship to it. Just allow it to exist as the seen. In the cognized, just the cognized, without wanting desires or fantasies or relationship to what we're fantasizing about, thinking about. When for you, there is only the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard in reference to the heard, only the sensed in reference to the sensed, only the cognized in reference to the cognized, then there is no you in connection to that. When there is no you in connection to that, there is no you there. When there is no you there, you are neither here nor yonder nor between the two. This, just this, is the end of suffering. So maybe, Lunkyiputta, in this, when the Buddha said, if there's a sight object and thing in the world you've never seen and never heard about, don't even know what it is, what's your relationship to that? Probably no desire, no aversion, but probably also not making any self into that. Me here, the object there, I want it, I don't want it, this is going to be mine, this will define me forever because I have this wonderful thing. There's no making of a self, there's no assuming a self in relationship to that object because one doesn't know it. And so that's supposed to give maybe the point as a pointing for Mulunkyaputta. When he says, when there's no you there, no you in relationship to it, there's no you there, no you here, and there's nothing in between. This is kind of the essence of this experience, or this pointing to not self. He's not saying there's nothing out there. He's saying in relationship to all these things we can experience in the senses, there's not this extra construction, an extra desire that's related to the self operating. I remember when I was 17, I was kind of a little bit of a hippie traveling around Europe in a Volkswagen bus, and it had only the front seats, so the back seat, I don't know what we were doing, we were sitting like on the tire wheel or something, or on the metal floor or something, but it was hot, and I remember a number of times I was just looking out the window in the back. And then I was seeing for sure, but I suddenly kind of realized in a sudden moment that I wasn't there. And this idea that I could see and I wasn't there was kind of like, what was that? I was I don't know if lost is the right word, but absorbed, involved in just seeing the scenery, but I wasn't doing anything or making anything of it or judging it or wanting any of it or making a self out of it. And I was just kind of like just being pulled in, absorbed into this scenery, into this ride through the countryside. And then suddenly, boom. Like, oh, so rather than waking up and being enlightened, it was more like I woke up and realized I was back. I was deluded, or I was, Gil had returned. I didn't know much about Buddhism, anything about Buddhism, so. But this idea of the construction of self and the placing ourselves in relationship to the experience, and is just an operation, function of the mind. It's activity of the mind. The mind constructs self, ideas of me in relationship to that. And we grow up doing that, and it's a necessary part of growing up to place ourselves in the world in relationship to other people and things and find our way, and we don't bump into things because we know that we're here and that objects are there. But it becomes kind of a habit, more than a habit, it becomes a deeply ingrained phenomena. It's certainly useful, but often it becomes a magnet for all kinds of suffering. And a very high percentage of people suffering is in relationship to this functional concept, functional construct of self that's helped us to get around, helps us to be safe. It's not a problem to have this kind of self in and of itself, but it happens to be that it's a magnet for all kinds of problems, all kinds of sufferings, and needing to be a certain person, being a good person, good kid, good child for your parents, needing to prove yourself and get good grades, and need to get good grades in order to be loved, or to be shamed for something you did, and then, well, I can't be that kind of person publicly, and so that goes underground because you have to be a certain kind of person, or not be a certain kind of person. And it just builds and goes on there. And probably each of us can write our autobiography that would describe the construction of certain kind of self that was formed as we kind of went through life. My seventh grade teacher looked over my shoulder, and she was an art teacher, looked over my shoulder as I was drawing, and I was drawing a pencil drawing of my hand. And I was struck by all the little, not wrinkles exactly, but all these little cracks in this, close up in the skin. So I was drawing them all in as part of my drawing. And she looked over my shoulder in the most ordinary, easy kind of way. This person of authority said something to someone who had no self in relationship to what she was going to say, to what I was doing. And she just said calmly, "You have no artistic ability." And I didn't have any self around needing to have artistic ability. I was in seventh grade. So I had no emotional impact on me whatsoever. However, she was the authority. So it must be true. So then I just added that to the collection of what's true about me. And I, for the next probably 6 years or so, that was part of that little, you know, those index cards of who I am that I stored away and, you know, just kept there as, you know, think, okay, that's who I am. She'd helped me construct this idea, certain idea around the self. And I don't think I ever suffered because of it, but you could easily imagine someone could or would. And then I had my roommate, my first year in college, was something like a born-again artist. And within months, he had me drawing. And by the second quarter, I was taking art class. And so it turned out I had some talent, a little bit of ability. So then that got shed, that index card got shed. So anyway, that's, you know, it's all this, you know, I can go on and on with stories about how this, growing up, all these things happened to me, and more index cards, and some of them were painful and really heavy, and some of them, you know, took Buddhist practice to finally put down. But this idea of not creating a self, not having a reference of self all the time, to have the experience of life being alive, just being alive is enough, just being settled, just being, allowing the mind to be simple and content and happy for just how we are. No need to apologize for ourselves, prove ourselves. No need to make great Buddhist attainments so we can get the, we know that we're a good person, a successful person. And clear comprehension of non-delusion. Clear comprehension that I don't have to create a self. I don't have to live in this self-construct. I can allow the unfolding of life just as it is. So this idea of the non-constructed, not being caught by the constructions of self, the ideas of self, this seems to have been much closer to what the Buddha was teaching when he taught not self. And you see here the Buddha, that to this Lunkyaputta, he's saying, when you are not in that, you're not there, you're not here, you're not in between. He's not saying you do not exist. But nothing in your experience, in any of the six senses, anything you can touch, see, smell, taste, hear, and this more difficult thing to understand, nothing that you can think, nothing that you can internal landscape can bring into the mind, none of that, that can exist there without you being constructed in relationship to it. There's no need for a self to be attributed to those things. Those things are not self. And the teachings on not self is always teachings about specifically what is not self. The experience of not self that is part of Vipassana practice is the recognition, the clear recognition, clear comprehension, that whatever arises moment by moment in experience, the immediacy of it, in and of itself, is not the self. And it's possible to watch how we make a self out of it, how we construct a self out of it, how it triggers a self. I can sit in meditation, and I could have a constricted breathing. I'm just going along nicely, my breath is going nicely, and then suddenly I discover my breathing is constricted. And then, that's just the breathing that's constricted. So, okay, great. And then I can watch the self getting formed around that. Well, I've been a Buddhist meditator for over 40 years. It's not supposed to be that way. And really, I must be a meditation failure. And I'm a teacher, so this is rather embarrassing. People probably expect me to always have a relaxed and easy breathing and never constricted, and I should never tell anyone publicly because that, you know, I'll just be, you know, and then the mind goes on, right? I just made this huge edifice of self out of it and just made it more and more complicated as I go on and on and on. And then I inflict other people on my, all of you, with my, you know, the kind of at least imaginary conversations I can have with myself. So to be so simple enough in experience, settled enough, quiet enough, so you can see the difference between a sound arising and a self being made in relationship to it. Well, that's a nice sound of a bell. I would like that bell. A smell occurring, a tactile experience occurring, and somehow it begins entering into the world of my preferences, my beliefs, my pleasure, my aversions, my safety, my this. All this me, myself, and my world comes into play. It's not necessarily wrong to do these things. However, freedom, there's a freedom and a deep release that's possible when we can stay simple. Just stay close or stay resting, stay at ease with how things actually arise and pass and flow through in the moment. Not dramatically, don't have a high standard. Just good enough, just enough, so you can watch the self being formed in relationship to it. It takes kind of being relaxed, at ease, and don't make a self out of trying to see the self. Just kind of just be there and just, oh, there it is, it arose. And so this principle, this idea of the simplicity of just a seeing, and so forth, even the principle of it, when the mind is relaxed enough, can help highlight the construction of self. And one of the things which we don't have to take as being the self, who I really am, what defines me, what my true identity is those things we watch, the constructions we see arising in the mind, the ideas and thoughts that we have. Some of those ideas and thoughts might be accurate enough, but what happens when the mind is quiet enough, we see that often these thoughts, these ideas, are not innocent. They come along with baggage. We come along with stress, with constriction, with tightness, with sometimes with shame, sometimes with delight, sometimes with conceit. It just goes on and on. It's very rare we have a very, you know, innocent idea of, you know, just some idea of self. But we do have them, and some are appropriate to have. But it's how we relate to those ideas. How tight do we construct and make that self around ourselves? So, it, you know, it's accurate enough that the thought that I am a 65-year-old man, that's, you know, that's accurate enough. Am I constructing a self around that? I can say that's what I am. I might be, or I might not be. I could care less about my age and what that says with me. In the age, I don't construct a self. It just, you know, it's like the wind outside or something. It's just an age, and this is how it is. So what this is pointing to also is that these teachings of not self are not a teaching that there is no self. It's not a denial of self. For over 100 years, Western scholars of Buddhism have argued, sometimes in whole books dedicated to this purpose, but whether the Buddha said there is no self or whether there is a self. And I think that the general consensus now, I think, among Buddhist scholars is that the Buddha was not interested in either possibility. He wasn't interested in the philosophy or proving or disproving that there is a self or there is not a self. What he's interested in is how the construction of self leads to suffering and how the construction of self can be put down, could be put to rest, and thereby finding some deep peace. He's not, you know, whether there is a self or not a self is just simply not that interesting for him. but that certain things are not the self, certain experiences are not self. That he's willing to say. And that's something that in Vipassana practice, at some point as we go along, it becomes obvious that something before that you saw as self, now you don't see as, it doesn't tie it to anything at all. If, you know, that there can be a thought that arises in the mind, there can be an emotion that arise, that in the past you would have seen, like you would have wrapped your whole self around it, your identity, your ideas, and your, you know, it would have reflected back on yourself. But it's possible to watch a thought arise, and it's, you say, well, that's interesting. I didn't will that, I didn't want that, and I didn't plan for that thought. It's just this thought bubbled up like a, you know, like a leaf blowing in the wind, a cloud in the sky moving through the sky. And a person says, well, that's interesting thought, but that's not my thought. It's just a thought. I don't need to take it as mine. Or an emotion. I've had anger arise during walking meditation on retreat. And I didn't, and it was kind of amazing the first time it happened, where the mind made no effort to define the anger in relationship to myself, to make any kind of claim or association with me and myself and mine. There was a sensations and feeling of anger that arose because someone had entered into my walking meditation path. That was my path. Maybe I'd made a self there. But the anger arose, and it was like it just went, it kind of, I kind of felt it move up and out of my head and disappear, all within about a second. Maybe because I didn't stick to it, or didn't do anything with it, or react to it, or use it to define myself with, or feel justified to have. Just, it's anger. And so in a sense, that anger experience, there was no self in that anger. It was just anger. So seeing it as not self in the anger. Does that mean there is no self? I don't have to answer that question. But I did want to end a little bit with, just so that in case some of you are troubled by this idea that the Buddha might have taught there is no self, but I'm a self, and how am I supposed to find my way with all this? The Buddha does use the word self, atta, atman, in positive ways. It's not only about negating the self or the atta, but perhaps when he talks about it in positive ways, we have to kind of a little bit maybe appreciate that he's certainly not using it in the way that the religious traditions of his time were using it. And this is, he was really kind of presenting a very different path to freedom than the path to freedom that some of the other spiritual seekers of his time were emphasizing. When they emphasized there is, in fact, a permanent, static, inactive, true self. And liberation is found through knowing this inactive, static, never-changing self thing. So there's a knowledge you're supposed to have, and then freedom comes. For the Buddha, he did not point to something like this. He pointed to the psychological processes that operate within us. And the knowledge in Buddhism is knowledge to understand how our inner processes work, to notice how we cling, how we pull away, how we lean forward, how we get weighed down by our thoughts and ideas, how we create a self, how we get trapped in desire and anger and conceit and resentments, how we cling, and how we relax the clinging, how we have ease, how we have joy, how joy is born and comes, how happiness comes, how wholesome states come and arise. These psychological processes are processes which are dynamic. They're not static. And that's why we can shape them and move them and free ourselves in the middle of them. And so to sit quietly and start being mindful, we're actually trying to be mindful of the process nature, the dynamic nature of our life. And we're becoming the caretakers of our inner life. And I think that when the Buddha uses the word atta in a positive terms, I don't think he's using it in the sense of this metaphysical sense of the Upanishads. I think he's using it just as a kind of a nice metaphor for our inner life, the quality of our inner life. Because Bodhi says sometimes when the Buddha uses the atta in positive terms, it's used as a synonym for the citta, for the mind, which is maybe saying the same thing I'm saying. I'm calling it the inner life. And it's this inner life that we have, that we are really, that's really the domain, the pasture, the refuge for our well-being, to cultivate deep sense of inner well-being, to cultivate a high-quality inner life, to be the caretakers of this inner life. So I wouldn't be surprised that the Buddha, who was so willing to use the words of his time and redefine them, use them in new ways. So he uses the word atta sometimes in his own meaning of it, not the earlier meanings of some static, eternal thing. I wouldn't be surprised if the Buddha lived today that he'd be quite content to use the word soul. And if he used the word soul, he probably would not have any of the current religious ideas of what a soul is. But he would say it's just your citta. It's your mind. It's your inner, the quality of your inner life that we want to care for and recognize. It's not a fixed thing. It's not some absolute thing, but it's something we care for in this practice. So I wanted to read to you a few ways in which the Buddha uses the word self in very positive terms. If one knows one's self is dear, the sage would guard one's self with care. I kind of added the ones in it. Literally, the passage is, if one knows the self is dear, the sage would guard the self with care. And then he goes on to the next line of the poem from the Dhammapada and uses this word which most translators translate as one would watch the mind, attend the mind. And those are probably the better translations. But the dictionary, one of the dictionary definitions is to nourish, to tend. One would tend the self. The Buddha in the Dhammapada also says, one's self is the refuge of oneself. The self is the refuge of oneself. What other refuge can there be? If you remember from a few days ago, I talked about the mind being the refuge for all the sense experience, and mindfulness, awareness, being the refuge for the mind. So here it's the self, which in the days before the Buddha died, he said, you should live as islands, being your own refuge, being your own refuge, with no one else as your refuge. So here the self, you yourselves, you know, to be your own refuge, for your mind to be a refuge, the self, the mind inside, there's a refuge here. There's some good here, something valuable here. You should live with the Dhamma as your islands, with the Dhamma as your refuge, with no other refuge. And how does one do this? Through observing the four foundations of mindfulness, through mindfulness. It's through mindfulness that one becomes one's own refuge. That puts the status of mindfulness, you know, pretty high. And then there's this wonderful verse in the Samyutta. Who loves the self? The Atta. Who loves the self? Who wishes for greatness? Should deeply revere the Dharma, remembering the Buddha's teachings. This is kind of very surprising language, because not only it talks about loving the self, when there's not supposed to be a self, is what some people say. And certainly you shouldn't be this idea of greatness, who wishes for greatness. But maybe there is an okay way to wish for greatness. This next verse, it's also the self is used, the Atta. And here in Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, he translates Atta as mind, so you don't see that in his translation, the self coming out. Having let go of conceit, the settled self, the good mind, is everywhere freed. So it seems like he's treating the settled self and the good mind maybe as synonymous. Having let go of conceit, the settled self, the good mind, is everywhere freed. Dwelling alone in the forest, diligent, one can cross beyond the realm of death. So for me, how I understand this is that through practice, through awareness, and through care and love and valuing what's here, that what's in here is dear, what's inside here is precious. And that we can love what's here. We can love this soul, or can love this inner life that we have. I prefer inner life. The word soul comes out of my mouth with difficulty, my own conditioning. But we can care for it, we can love it, we can tend it, we can be nourished by it, we can nourish it. That we have something here. And that the mindfulness, the awareness, a simple awareness of practice that begins to help us get out of the way, to not have so many constructs and ideas of self, and so many selves that we have put on, all these index cards we've gathered through our lifetime. Imagine that your mind finally learns that index cards are not really cool anymore. And people don't use them very much anymore. it's okay to put it down. You probably don't need this big collection of all these selves that you've been carrying with you. It's okay to breathe easily, and it's okay to hear the sounds around you easily. It's okay to just sit and be at ease. It's okay to have awareness open, present, without having to solve anything and fix anything and make anything happen. It's okay to be alive and to be awake. It's okay to hear, see, smell, taste, touch, and cognize without any desire for it, without any self in relationship to it. And if there is desire and self in relationship to it, that can be okay too. That's also not self. That's also something not, you don't have to do anything with it. You don't have to make more of it. This idea of not making more of things, for me, this is phenomenally respectful. It means that every experience that we have is allowed to be its own thing, its own pristine event by itself. So I hope that having heard all this, that it can be an encouragement to let meditation be simple, to let being alive be simple. And you have this opportunity for the next couple of days to take the risk, take some risks by trying out being simple. Take some risks in keeping things simple. Just simple enough that you might notice when you begin making a self. Notice when you get caught in desires and aversion, they arise. Not to not have them, but to see them arise and perhaps see them as those too are not self. And maybe you'll wake up. If you don't wake up, it would be nice if you're at least amused by what this mind of ours is capable of. So may you enjoy these next days, and thank you very much.